The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
One of the ways to think about our practice is that we're exploring how we think of ourselves, how we think of who we are, what we think of as who we are. There's a famous quote by Dogen that says, to study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And to forget the self is to be enlightened by the myriad things. And so this first piece, to study the way is to study the self. I mean, this is actually a lot of what we're doing in our practice. It's a curiosity. I mean, there's a teaching in Buddhism. The Buddha teaches form is not self, feelings are not self, perceptions are not self, consciousness is not self, and mental formations are not self. And basically saying, you know, everything in our experience it falls into one of those categories of those various aspects of our mind. And nothing in our experience can qualify as self. And so that's a teaching, and yet we can't. The sense of self is such a strong sense in all of us. I think it seems to be something that we're born with and conditioned with at a very deep level, this sense of I am. And it feels so intuitive. It feels so natural and obvious, in fact. It seems like so obvious that I am that, we don't even think to question it. We don't even think to look at it. What is it that I think of as I or me? We take it for granted. We just think that we are. And so the Buddha has a teaching, an exploration. It's like, well, what we think of as I or me isn't what we think of it as. We think of I or me as being something solid or permanent, something perhaps that has been there since we were born and will carry through until we die, perhaps. For some of us, that may be the way that we think about it. Some of us may think about it as a kind of a sense of a soul or a, you know, something that will transcend our life and go beyond life to another life. Or, and so we have various senses of what we think of as self. And usually it involves some kind of sense of a thing that's carried around with us, either in our bodies or that it has our bodies, or that it is our knowing, it is our mind, it is our, you know, this sense of what we are. It's not very examined, actually, but there's a feeling I am. And the Buddha pointed to, you know, well, what we think of as I am isn't a thing. It's a process. And we've misattributed to this process a solidity. So the exploration isn't about trying to figure out how I'm not a self, but more, what is it that I am calling self? And that very exploration of what is it that I'm calling self? What is it that I think of as I or me or mine? What is that? That will begin to reveal that it is not what we think it is. It is that rather there is this stream, this unfolding flow, a process that's happening rather than there being a thing. I've used the analogy of a river or a rainbow. Maybe I'll use a rainbow this time. A rainbow has some kind of a, You know, it does. We can't say a rainbow doesn't exist, right? Because there it is. We can all look at it. We can all see it. We can point to it. We can, you know, like, yes, there's a rainbow in the sky, you know. But what we know what a rainbow is a set of conditions coming together. There's the sun, there's moisture in the air, there's the position of our eye as the observer, and all of those things coming together creates the experience of rainbow. There was a, Joseph Goldstein talks about a situation that he was in once where in Hawaii, they have, on the island of Hawaii, they have these lava tubes, and you know, the water comes in from the ocean and kind of spurts up in the lava tubes. And he was standing in just a particular place that as one of those spurts came up, a rainbow appeared in that spurt. Now, if he'd been standing, you know, 20 feet to the other side, he might not have seen that, right? I mean, with the rainbow in this, a big rainbow in the sky, you know, you can go a long way. You can drive way down the freeway and it kind of seems like it's there. But with this kind of an experience, it's like, wow, 20 feet to the side and I wouldn't see that rainbow. So there's the conditions that come together of the water and the sun and the position of the observer that creates the experience of rainbow. Now, the person standing 20 feet away is not experiencing rainbow. So rainbow, in this sense, is a process. It's a set of conditions coming together that produces experience. And the Buddha says this is more what we mistake of as a thing, as a sense of self, is more this kind of thing, that it's a process of conditions coming together and falling apart over and over again. And these processes, he identified some specific processes in the mind where we tend to confuse those processes for identity. And I talked last week about these processes, and I'll just name them here. I won't go into as much detail as I did last week, but I want to explore one particular analogy about these processes. So the bodily process. You know, there's the process of body, and we, you know, even if we think about it in terms of, you know, what we know about science-wise with the body, as long as there is life in this body, cells are dividing, cells are being sloughed off, we're taking in nourishment, and new cells are being created, new mental connections, new neuronal connections are being formed. There's this bodily process. It digests, it eats, it's impinged by the world. It's a process. It's an ever-changing process. Even this thing that we, you know, walk around with and think of, this is me. We do tend to identify body as me sometimes. Science tells us that almost every cell in our body is replaced every 7 years. So even this body is a process. So body is one of the processes the Buddha pointed to as being a strong place where we identify with. And then feeling and perception, I'll just talk about these briefly together. Feeling, just this, it's a mental process of, you know, basically contact with the world, you know, that we take in experience as a felt sense. And the Buddha highlighted basically pleasant, unpleasant, neutral as being the basic felt way we take in the world. And again, this is a set of changing phenomenon. As we walk through the world, there's never a moment when it's always the same as it was the last moment in terms of the feelings that are being impinged on. And there's a process in our mind that receives feelings. And then perception, that we walk through the world and recognize what's happening to us. You know, this process started when we were a baby. This process of starting to recognize things. My understanding is that initially, particularly in the visual field, you know, that there's, you know, form and color out there, and you begin to recognize certain pink blotches as mom, and other pink blotches or brown blotches or, you know, as dad. And, you know, it's like this process of beginning to recognize the world, beginning to recognize things that we've experienced before as something we've experienced before. This is a process in our mind that it's a very natural process that, you know, just happens, that we learn how to recognize things. So that process of perceiving is also a process. It's you know, we just think about how our minds work to learn to recognize things. We come into contact with things over and over again, and our mind begins to identify, oh, that's a chair, that's a wall, that's a light, that's a person, that's mother, that's father, that's son, that's... So we begin to recognize things. Just, again, it's a very natural way that our minds work to recognize things. And then another area that the Buddha identified as, you know, just as a process in the mind, a doing process. Now, the perceiving and feeling are how we receive the world. We can think of that. Perceiving and feeling are how we receive the world. Then there's a kind of a process that engages with the world. That's like, okay, yes, that's pleasant, let's do something about that. That's unpleasant, let's do something about that. So there's a process that engages. And the Buddha identified that as being another really key process in the mind, the process that decides, that chooses, that thinks about. So this area actually includes a lot of what happens to us. And I think I'll come back to this area, because this, I think, is a big area of where we take our sense of self. I'm the one who decides. I'm the one who chooses. Also, the whole emotional terrain comes into this area. You know, feelings of anger and confusion and impatience or miserableness. And so much of our ways we kind of congeal around who I am is often identities around emotional states. And so that's a place I want to come back to and explore with you in a little bit. And then the fifth area is consciousness, or this process that basically knows things. And like with perception and feeling, this knowing sense is kind of a way that we receive the world. Those three, I think, knowing, feeling, and recognizing. That's how we take in experience. Now, with each of these processes the Buddha identified, you know, he said, this is what our life is comprised of, these processes. Much like the water is a process, the light is a process, and the seeing of, you know, being in a particular position and taking in, that those are kind of processes. The water comes and goes. The light may be obscured by a cloud or not. So there are processes happening. And much the same way the Buddha described our entire experience in terms of these processes. And with each of these processes, he said, each of these processes has a kind of way that it fools us into thinking there's a solidity there. And in particular, the one I want to look at today is the process of knowing, which the Buddha said, you know, this is like a magic show. He said that consciousness, or this process of knowing, he said, it's just like there's a magician that's come to town and is standing at a crossroads and doing its tricks, and someone with good eyesight comes along and watches this magician and recognizes, this is magic tricks. There's nothing of substance here. He says, just so, consciousness is kind of like a magician. It creates this illusion of something, but someone with really clear eyesight recognizes, this is a conjuring. This is an illusion. And so this is an analogy I'd like to explore a little bit today, the idea of the magic show, of our sense of being someone, of being a self, is basically a conjuring. It's an illusion. And there's those two pieces of it. You know, there's the conjuring, which is a magician. Again, it's a series of steps they go through with sleight of hand and, you know, concealing various actions, knowing how to direct your attention, that they can create the illusion of something. So there's a kind of a conjuring up of the desired illusion. And in a way, the consciousness is conjuring up this illusion of, something coming together and being a thing, in a way. Like the Buddha talks about this, the process of consciousness, as having six parts to it. There's a consciousness of seeing. And we can recognize there's sight that comes in, and there's a knowing of sight. There's sound that comes in, and there's a knowing of sound. There's smelling and hearing and tasting and touching. And then there's stuff happening in the mind. And the Buddha said these are just six separate things. And part of the way I think about this analogy of the magic show is that consciousness kind of conjures the whole thing as seeming like one seamless experience. You know, when I look at somebody and they're talking to me, it's not like my mind goes seeing, hearing, understanding. It's not; they're not separate. Whew. It's all together. This is really useful. You know, I can look at you and know that you're talking. Your mouth is moving. I know that the voice is coming from you. I understand that there are thoughts in your mind that are creating those. I mean, it's like there's a lot that the mind is putting together to have there be an understanding of the world through these senses. And so this is not a problem necessarily. It's not a problem that the mind is conjuring these things to seem like it's all one experience. And yet a problem can arise when we don't know that it is a conjuring. Why would that be? Why would that introduce a place of confusion? And I think that it introduces confusion because the mind in that, you know, that conjuring of this is a reality takes it to be truth. And in a way there's a lot of truth here, right? I mean, I have a great deal of confidence that there are actually people here in this room. So, you know, it's like this, the mind is conjuring this in a way because I used the analogy last week of Plato's cave, you know, what I am experiencing of this room is conjured in my mind. And yet it does represent something. That conjuring in my mind does represent a reality. Much as in Plato's cave, there were people, I think the thing was that there were people walking outside and people were chained in the cave and they were seeing the reflection or the shadows on the wall of the people who were walking outside. So there was some reality to what they were experiencing. You know, but it was not the full picture, and it was only a shadow of what was being experienced. And I think much in the same way, the very way our minds work is to take what's out there, and all of our whole experience is processed through this mind and body, and then the mind will create a reality, and it is that reality that's created in the mind that is actually being experienced. Does this make sense? I mean, So the confusion can come when we don't see that what we are relating to as reality is a construction of our own minds. Because when we take what's in our minds as reality, there are other processes at work in our mind of confusion, of greed, of wanting, of opinions, of agendas that overlay that created reality and have us pulling certain things out of it that are important and seeing other things as not important. And so we take that construct of mind, we take that conjuring to be reality and don't begin to distinguish what parts are extra, what's added. So that's how it can cause us trouble, when we don't understand, when we don't see that what we are actually experiencing and knowing is all simply a reflection in the mind, and that reflection in the mind is very easily colored by ideas, opinions, agendas, mind states. So the beginning to recognize and beginning to explore our experience as a conjuring helps us to be a little lighter about how we're relating to the world. Not take our perspective on what's happening to be the only truth. It's kind of mind-blowing when we... I've experienced just a few times the direct experience of seeing or knowing, you know, there's nothing here that I am experiencing that is the actual thing. And it's very disconcerting to see that, to recognize that. And so at a kind of very deep level, I know that, although I'm certainly not living from that place. I mean, it's like I walk around in the world and it's like, yeah, I mean, that conjuring is happening. And I mean, when I think about it, I can recognize or know, yeah, that's a conjuring. And it can help me. So that just that recognition of this is a magic show can help me to a kind of question, is some of what's going on here my own perspective, my own perception, my own beliefs and views, which a lot of the times it is. So, use the mic. Could you use the mic? There should be a switch on the side. No, there's a... Should be a light. There we go. Okay.
Thank you. Just a thought. How can we become the observer in this process?
There's two ways I can take your question. Can you describe a little bit more what the question you're actually asking is?
It's just when we're listening to someone speak and we know that this is kind of a conjuring up, and I know that it has nothing to do with me, what my personal goal is to be the observer in this conversation and not to react from that wounded child or that part
right.
of me that's
uh-huh.
taking it in as ego.
So that this is the exploration of, you know, to study the self. So the part of the way this can start to happen is that we recognize what are the perspectives we are bringing to experience. So what's going on? So this gets to the second part that I wanted to get to, like what's going on? Where do we identify? So even just hearing this information can help to shake us up a little bit and ask this kind of question. How might I watch experience or get to know experience? And what you said was without looking from the perspective of the wounded child. Well, the first exploration is knowing that the perspective of the wounded child is there. And so that becomes then, what happens is that the mindfulness of the kind of a curious perspective of what's happening right now begins to reveal, okay, there's a perspective happening here right now. There is this wounded child perspective. And that basically takes it from the place of being completely believing the magic show to recognizing, oh, there's a magic show here. There is a wounded child stuff going on here. So that the very opening to what's happening now, what perspectives, those are questions we could ask. What's the perspective I'm bringing? What is the suffering? That's another great exploration. Is there a struggle happening right now? If there's some kind of struggle happening, there is a perspective being seen through. I mean, there's a perspective that's happening. And so when we can recognize, okay, there's struggle happening right, okay, there's confusion happening right now. When we can see that, it begins to move it from the realm of being completely entranced by the magic of that confusion into recognizing confusion is happening now. That's a huge difference. So that essentially, the first place, so this is to study the self, right? So we don't try to say, how can I see things without the perspective? We explore, can I know this is a perspective? And that begins to make it, it's almost like it takes it from being solid to just being more ephemeral, kind of like a gauze rather than a solid color. So this is what I would like to look at here with you. Like, what kinds of perspectives do you bring? And let's think about it and explore a little bit. This is that terrain, like the wounded child, for instance, is in the terrain of that, how we engage with the world. You know, what I call the mental formations or the doing side of life. We receive information and we have learned to engage from perspective. And this area is a big area of identification. And so if we can begin to reveal, at least even recognize, oh, these are processes in the mind, these kind of identifications. Here's the wounded child process coming up. Here's the angry 40-year-old process. Here's the, delighted 50-year-old process. You know, like what are these processes? And to recognize that they are processes as opposed to solid. Just that begins to help us to be an observer of the self. So what are some of your processes? Let's begin to explore. What are some of your processes at work? Anybody willing to offer some of the processes that you are? Yeah, and use the mic. Could you use the mic?
Concepts, taking the parts. As you describe them, putting them together, mind likes to make concepts out of them and give it form and shape.
Yes, that is the whole, that whole area of creation of concept is a huge area of it's a process in our mind, and that's really that area, part of that conjuring essentially, is that we, in the recognition of concepts, we take that concept and then we experience the world through that concept rather than meeting what's actually happening directly. And we, well, it could be a concept of anything. It could be a concept of chairs. Or, I'll start with something maybe a little easier to connect with. So the concept of who somebody else is, for example. You know, this person is my friend, my enemy, my partner, and that concept, so, you know, there is perhaps some objective, I mean, we all agree on what the meanings of these concepts are to some extent, although not always, And so, you know, friend, for example, somebody that you spend time with, who you have a sense of being able to communicate with and share certain things with. You may have different levels of friendship with different people, but you have some ideas about friend. And so, you know, when you are seeing a person through that lens of friend, you're bringing with it a lot of other ideas about what a friend should do, what a friend shouldn't do, how they should react or respond. So, you know, you're seeing, and then it may create some judgment when they don't respond in the way that your idea says, this is what a friend is. So, yeah, seeing, so you're not actually seeing the person as themselves. You're seeing through the idea of friend and what they should be. And that could, I mean, we have so many concepts in our minds, and this, the concept area is kind of a shortcut for our brains. I mean, the neuropsychologists, the neuroanatomists, and they say if we didn't have this process in our minds, it would be exhausting to live in the world. You know, we'd have to, you know, like babies, use so much processing power to begin to learn to recognize things. You know, that's partly why they have to sleep so much. That, you know, there's a lot of energy that it takes to learn to recognize the world. And then as the mind begins to recognize things, the brain can recognize them more quickly. And so it takes that shortcut, which is it's energy efficient to take that shortcut. And yet the believing the shortcut to be reality is where the confusion can enter. So that, again, this is like the conjuring in a way, the magic show of the mind as a whole. It takes what is coming in and it's like it's put it all together into one thing, and then it takes that to be what is. The being able to see that, or really just being able to see that the mind is creating what we're experiencing, leads a whole humility. Yeah.
I don't know if this is what you're talking about, but I was originally going to be in Colorado right now at 11,000 feet in a cabin. And the trip with my husband got changed several times. It was back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And in the final change with the car breakdown, and we were like, we finally got it down to, we have this belief, if we go through this struggle of our camping journey across the desert, and we go up this mountain, and we finally relax, and we feel the beauty of nature and the view, and we feel the grand mystery of the divine, and there we are. And wait a minute, it's all
happening here.
That's all an illusion, and it's right here, right now. So who has to go anywhere?
Exactly. That's beautiful. That's a beautiful example.
And here I get to be this morning while my husband sleeps in, because what he needs is rest.
That's a beautiful example of just how our minds work. You know, that whole construction of, you know, where do I need to go in order to be happy? You know, that's a whole belief process at work. And yes, there, you know, we tend to that. We're reality creators. And, you know, the mind has created this whole, you know, oh, I need to do all these things, go there, be there. And if you did go through all those things, there could be a beautiful experience. And it's also possible to just open to, I mean, there's no special place for reality to be revealed. It can happen anywhere. And sometimes Joseph Goldstein says, you know, only 6 things ever happen. Ever. Seeing, smelling, hearing, tasting, touching, and stuff going on in our minds. We happen to like certain configurations of those six things better than others. We have beliefs about certain configurations of those six things that lead us to seek out those. And yet, in terms of waking up, this kind of waking up that the Buddha pointed to, it doesn't matter what those configuration of six things are. I heard that on Sunday, were any of you here on the Sunday morning program for Jacques Verdun? I heard he does this program bringing mindfulness and this practice into prisons. And he apparently brought someone with him who had spent 25 years in prison. Two people that had spent 25 years in prison. And, you know, they used that, my understanding, they used that time to wake up. You know, that it doesn't take particular conditions to wake up. It takes a shift of mind to recognize what's happening right now and being interested in what's happening right now. This beginning to kind of puncture holes in that magic show. You know, it's kind of like one author wrote this book called The Magic of the Mind, and he begins with this analogy of the magic show, and he says, you know, just imagine you were somebody who, you know, the magician's coming to town, it's your favorite magician, and, you know, with a full crowd, and you have to slip in from the back in order to get into the show, and you find yourself in this spot on the stage that's kind of behind the scenes. And so you're watching the magic show from this perspective, and you see how all the tricks are happening. And as the show goes on, you get more and more disenchanted with this magician, because you see it's all just a conjuring, and it's not really happening. And then he says, and then you look out at the crowd, and you see the awe on their faces and the amazement and the oohs and ahs. And you're like, wait a minute, you know, what's happening here? You know, these people are like seeing something completely different than I am. And so this exploration of our experience begins to put us behind the scenes in the magic show of our mind, to begin to help us to see that this is magic. Now, it doesn't stop the magic show. It doesn't make the magic show stop. And it can't stop, actually. You know, it's like we need that magic show to live our lives. We need those concepts. We need to recognize when somebody comes into our field of vision who they are, and that person speaking is that person speaking and not somebody, you know, from outer space talking. You know, it's like, we need that to navigate our lives. We need that magic show. And yet, we also need to understand that it is an illusion, that it is a kind of creation, because when we don't understand it's a magic show, we're entranced, and our own delusions, our own ideas, our own opinions, our own views get in the mix and create havoc, create a big mess. So more comments. Joel. There's a mic in front of you, Mary.
I think actually we were talking a little bit last night after the meeting. So the mind will go out there and see all these beautiful things, or just, gee, I'm having a wonderful day, and then something will come up. Oh yeah, but I had that argument 3 days ago, and you know, and it'll kind of almost spoil what happened. And the opposite can happen, where one could be in a negative mind state. I mean, I know with me, and I say, okay, right now, I can maybe think a good thought, like a loving kindness thought. I have that choice. I mean, I may get caught up in my negative stuff, but maybe I have enough to be able to at least get that thought. So that's how I see my process sometimes. And watch myself do kind of both sides.
You know, with being aware of the magic show as a magic show, we get to participate in the creation of reality.
Yeah.
So as we see, you know, that magic show is being created particularly by our habits, often by our habits. And yet when we begin to wake up to the magic show as a magic show, we can start to use that process of doing to choose how to have the reality come together. So, you know, this is the whole way the practice of mindfulness and our meditation practice unfolds, that there is some choice that we make. We can choose loving kindness. We can choose to be mindful. We can choose to be a witness instead of the hapless, you know, a person who's just like carried off down the stream of our habits and patterns. We can choose to know this is what's happening. And that very witnessing, you know, that very turning towards or bringing in a wholesome mind state instead of being habitually caught by our unwholesome mind states begins to like change the course of that magic show. Now, it's helpful to recognize that, yes, that addition of loving kindness is just another conjuring. Yeah. You know, it's a helpful conjuring in this situation. So, you know, again, you know, we don't stop the magic show, but we learn the ins and outs, I guess, of working with that magic show. And then, you know, over time, you know, initially there's kind of sometimes a belief around practice. As we learn about this witness, for instance, and that the instructions of mindfulness practice being, you know, observe what's happening rather than necessarily trying to change or construct something. Can you, you know, take that stepped back stance of observing? Well, that's really the first step in a way. You know, that's the getting to know what's here and getting to know, okay, this is the magic show that's happening. Okay, that's what's going on. And then the mistaken idea is that that's all that we're supposed to do. And that we think sometimes with this observer that we're not supposed to participate in the unfolding of reality. But this body-mind process is designed to participate in the unfolding of reality. And so can we, and initially what we need to do is bring in consciously the direction or the skillfulness of being the observer, of bringing in wholesome qualities, of orienting towards kindness and compassion. And the more we kind of head our magic show in that direction, the more we can even see all of it as just an unfolding process.
So that's where non-judgment comes.
Yes, yes. Yeah, and initially we have to like try on non-judgment. You know, it's not like we don't go to non-judgment immediately, but it's like, okay, sometimes one of my teachers calls this borrowing wisdom. You know, we borrow wisdom from what we hear. It's like, okay, can I take the stance of non-judgment? And, you know, maybe not completely, but, you know, we can just orient ourselves a little bit. What might it mean to just watch this right now instead of being tumbled forward in the magic show of this pattern? What might it be to watch that? And then in the very watching of that magic show, a great part happens is that there's a natural like wisdom part of our magic show that begins to help us to orient towards more wholesome things. And so initially that wisdom is brought in more kind of consciously. You know, oh, you know, we can use wisdom like this is impermanent. This is this is unreliable.
Like that.
You don't like the unreliable?
No.
Sometimes it's great to recognize things as unreliable. This is nature is another one that I like. That one to me really points to the process mode of experience. One of my teachers recommended that one as a borrowed wisdom for me. You know, it's like, and what that one says to me, or the way it, you know, he said, just try recognizing this is nature. And so when like a state of depression came up, it's like, okay, this is nature. You know, what that did in my mind was it's like, you know, what is nature? Nature's a process that naturally unfolds. You plant a seed, an apple seed, and if the conditions are right, there's water, there's moisture, there's nourishment, the tree will grow. It's just there's conditions unfolding. Nature is a kind of a very natural, organic unfolding process. When I began recognizing my states of mind as this is nature, it's like, oh yeah, wow, you know, this process of depression, this has happened before. In fact, you know, this has been a way that this mind is oriented towards life a lot. So it's been practiced. That mind state has been well watered. It's gotten a lot of nourishment. It's grown a lot. So, of course, depression is happening right now. It really took that sense of this depression is me. Oh, I'm depressed. It's like this depression is a natural process that's unfolding because of conditions from the past. And you know, in this moment, the other great thing or the other kind of orientation of wisdom is that as we meet that process with that curious mindfulness, that non-judgmental mindfulness, it allows that, it creates new nature. It creates new nature in that moment. And so it actually, what that mindfulness does in that moment is it starts to denourish the conditions that support the growth of that tree, that pattern. So yeah, this is nature is a real pointer to the process nature of whatever's happening. For me, it was a very powerful recognition, particularly around some of my challenging mind states, my, you know, the habitual patterns that I got caught in. So more around, things you get caught in.
If it's true, which I'm coming to believe, that there is not a self, I'm wondering why some processes have lasted so long.
So are you speaking?
And I'm going to mention
ones?
One
yeah,
of them.
Okay.
In fact, I just carried it out by trying something humorous in here. Well, I can go back to when I first went to first grade, and I have thought about this lately because I've been looking at some photographs of me and my colleagues in elementary school. When the first day I went to first grade, sometime during the day I cried. It took me many years to figure out why I cried. And the best explanation I have now is that in that new context, meaning a first grade classroom compared to, you know, being a kid at home with mom around all the time, I didn't know how to get my sense of specialness or my need for specialness met. And, you know, I've learned that sometimes humor works nowadays. Some 65 years later. So that process I repeat over and over and over again.
Looking for being
looking
special?
For someone to looking for some way to in and particularly in a group that I'm not that I don't know. I look for some recognition that someone will treat me as if I'm special, superior, better than whatever.
Yeah. So, you know,
and I really work this game hard at times.
So you mean you've practiced that a lot?
I've practiced it a lot, yes.
That's why it sticks around.
My sense of self.
That's why it sticks around. That's exactly why it sticks around for so long, because it's been practiced a lot.
Yeah, I know.
And so, you know, to begin to turn to every time it happens, and it's great that you've seen it happening kind of more in group settings, in group situations, you know, there's probably some feeling of lack that springs
up. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, a feeling of lack that springs up first that's not clearly acknowledged as a feeling of lack. And then the process that has been most practiced is finding a way, maybe through humor in this case, you know, finding a way to have that lack filled.
Yep.
And so, the mind in its habitual way, you know, it's like, our minds want to have some kind of satisfaction. They want to be happy. They want to be at ease. And those shortcuts that I talked about, you know, the mind has, as a young child, found ways towards ease that the mind considered kind of a shortcut to happiness. And so, the mind not seeing, essentially, you know, again, so there's some things not seen, and in this case, in particular, the feeling of lack isn't so seen, and the feeling of reaching forward towards something to fill that lack is not seen. There's the what the mind does is kind of projects forward to when I get, it's just like the trip, you know, it's just like the trip to the mountains that's happening in a 30-second time span. You know,
oh, yeah.
It's like, if I can get that thing, that acknowledgement, that will be happiness. And so the mind is leaping forward 10 seconds or 30 seconds to a happiness that it thinks it will get by engaging in that behavior, not recognizing that the very engagement in that behavior is itself suffering. Because the mind has projected forward to, that's where I'll be happy. And it's living in that reality of 10 seconds or 5 seconds in the future, that's where I'll be happy. And so that very living in that reality of that conjuring, a magic show right there, that living in that reality of that future obscures the pain that we're going through in order to create that reality. And so this is part of how mindfulness works. It begins to reveal the strategies that we habitually use to be not so satisfactory, ultimately. So we go through...
And then I have another element to this that I'm just become aware of.
We have to stop now.
Oh, we do, don't we? Yeah. Well, maybe I'll be back next week.
Okay. So thank you all. I really appreciate the participation of the group. Thank you.